Well, welcome to episode 18 of Primary Care Update. I'm Dr. Mark A. Bell. I'm a family doc, professor at UGA, and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus, an evidence-based online primary care reference with over 800 chapters, 5,000 calculators, 500 clinical decision rules, a lot more, mainly written by and for primary care physicians, urgent care physicians, and ED physicians. Please check it out at EssentialEvidencePlus.com. Primary Care Update is our summary of some recent research that we think is relevant to primary care clinicians. The opinions expressed are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. I'm joined by my friends, Dr. John Hickner, editor of the Journal of Family Practice, and Dr. Henry Berry, professor of family medicine at Michigan State University. Hey, guys, how are you doing?
Doing well. Mark, and you cut your trip short because of your knee. I'm sorry to hear that. But, you know, John and I have had a good time. We were in Colorado recently speaking at a conference with the Colorado Academy of Family Physicians. We're almost 170 people in attendance. We had a great conference feedback, great interaction among the attendees, and I hope we get to come back next year.
Those are excellent family physicians in Colorado. They really seem to be on the ball. Lots of great questions, lots of input, and several of them commented that they listen to our podcasts.
Excellent. Okay. Well, everyone spread the word about the podcast. And also, we will announce any upcoming CME conferences that we're teaching at. These are generally sponsored by the Academies of Family Medicine in different locations. I think so far, you guys have been, since I was out of the country, you guys have been in Arizona, Colorado, I think Wisconsin. Is that right?
That's correct. And Illinois.
And Illinois, yeah. And we'll be in Cleveland in the fall, so we'll get the dates on that out soon. I messed up my knee a little bit while I was in Dublin. I'm not sure exactly what I did. I'll be getting that sorted out this week. But knees are strange things. I have pain when I walk more than 100 meters, and yet I rode my bike 15 miles yesterday. So who knows? It's kind of a strange thing. Anyway, I'm going to talk, the first poem I'm going to be talking about is mine. I'll be talking about one of my favorite topics, me, or actually research that I did with my graduate students, Christian Marcello and Ariella Dale. They both got their doctorates last year, and their work just came out in the Journal of the American Board of Family Medicine. Christian led this project, and it is, I think, very primary care relevant. We usually think in, by the way, it was in JABFM in 2019, volume 32, issue 2, which I guess makes it February, page 234, and it's called Signs and Symptoms That Rule Out Community-Acquired Pneumonia in Outpatient Adults, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. So we usually think about ruling in diagnoses and making a positive diagnosis. You know, you have pneumonia, you have diabetes, you have hypertension. But in a lot of cases, we're trying to sort the needles in the haystack, and we're trying to rule out more serious conditions. So in patients with cough or, you know, presenting with respiratory tract symptoms, which ones don't have a pneumonia, which ones, particularly in a rural setting where it may be harder to get some of these studies like a chest x-ray even, you know, how can we identify patients who don't need a chest x-ray, don't need further evaluation, where we can comfortably rule out pneumonia and then hopefully also help the patient understand why they don't need antibiotics. So we did the usual kind of Medline search, and we did a paired review of all the abstracts. And we looked for studies that were done in the outpatient setting, either primary care or ED. And they had to use chest x-ray or CT as the reference standard. And they had to enroll either a random or consecutive set of patients. And they had to be adolescents or adults. So we excluded kids. We found 12 studies that met the inclusion criteria, 6 in the ED and 6 in primary care. They ranged in size from 246 to 2,820 patients. 6 studies were low risk of bias and the other 6 were moderate. So none of them were at high risk of bias, which is good. The combination of normal vital signs, so normal temp, less than 101, respiratory rate 20 or lower, heart rate of 100 or lower, plus a normal lung exam, so no crackles or changes on a lung exam, excluded community-acquired pneumonia. So again, normal temp, normal respiratory rate, normal heart rate, normal lung exam. Those patients, you can be very comfortable ruling out pneumonia. The negative likelihood ratio was 0.1. What that means is in the typical outpatient primary care setting among patients who come in with cough and maybe some lower respiratory symptoms like sputum production or maybe fever or chills or sore chest, about 4%, 3 to 4% have pneumonia. If they have normal vitals and normal lung exam, less than 0.4% will have pneumonia. So you can really very comfortably rule that out. So hopefully a little practice pearl for you today.
I love it when you talk stats to me.
Oh yeah, Henry. We do like to nerd out on this podcast on occasion. Any comments about that?
I have one question for you. This kind of patient with normal vital signs and a normal lung exam, I'm not so worried about pneumonia from the beginning. How about the patient who has a normal lung exam but has fever? Did you take a look at that at all? Because that's the patient I start to worry about a bit.
Yeah, we weren't able to separate that out. The studies that we looked at didn't identify, as far as I can remember, that particular patient. And fever is a predictor of pneumonia, as is increased pulse, as are crackles on exam. We'll talk about that a little later. But there was a study done in patients with cough, low respiratory symptoms, you know, quote, acute bronchitis. And in that study, about two-thirds had sputum production, about two-thirds had some degree of fever, and they were randomized to azithromycin or placebo, and there was no benefit seen. So, you know, in that group, I mean, I think really what turns it for me is, you know, hearing crackles. And again, we'll talk a little later we'll finish up the podcast by talking about what does rule in community-acquired pneumonia. So stay tuned.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so these are great tools to help to guide us when we are concerned about a single entity like pneumonia. Mm-hmm. But from time to time, we do have to make sure that we're paying attention and stepping back and looking at the bigger picture. Just within the last couple of weeks, I saw a woman for a sick call I'd never seen before. She had kind of allergy symptoms, sniffles and the like, but was also complaining of a really annoying, dry, non-productive cough that just wouldn't go away. Her exam was pretty unremarkable other than a nasal polyp and some clear rhinorrhea. But because she was actually getting treatment for breast cancer, still getting active treatment, I felt like I needed to get a chest x-ray. And unfortunately, she has signs of pleural-based metastases. So, you know, there are times where we have to make sure we're paying attention to the rest of the picture and not just the presenting complaint.
Yeah, exactly. These kinds of clinical prediction rules are decision support, not decision replacement. And, you know, we always have to look at the whole picture. And in fact, we did a separate study with the same group of researchers looking at clinical gestalt, sort of the overall clinical impression. And for pneumonia, the overall clinical impression of an experienced primary care doctor is very good. It's as good as any clinical decision rule. These should be a check on our decision making, but they obviously shouldn't replace it. So that's a great point, Henry. Thanks. So I get the quiz this month. I'm giving Henry a break. So we just learned how to rule out community-acquired pneumonia. What about ruling it in? An elevated level of which of the following blood tests is the best predictor of community-acquired pneumonia among patients presenting with lower respiratory tract infection in primary care? A, the white blood cell count. B, serum procalcitonin. C, a left shift in the differential. And D, C-reactive protein. As Henry says, stay tuned. John, it's your turn. We're going to talk a little about e-cigarettes.
Yes, this is the first really good randomized trial that I've seen testing whether e-cigarettes can be an effective way to help patients quit smoking. This was published in New England Journal in 2019, volume 380, starting on page 629. This was a randomized trial in the United Kingdom that compared e-cigarettes with nicotine replacement therapy. Patients could choose their preferred method. They could choose a nasal spray, inhaler, mouth spray, gum, etc., or a patch. So the patients were randomized then, 884 of them, to the nicotine replacement or to an e-cigarette, and they could experiment with different forms and flavors of e-cigarettes until they found one they liked. The patients then were followed up at 1 year. So this is a long-term follow-up study, and the outcomes were well measured by self-report of abstinence that was confirmed by carbon monoxide levels. So well done study. The e-cigarettes performed better than nicotine replacement. 18% in the e-cigarette group were abstinent at 1 year as opposed to 9.9% in the nicotine replacement group. Now, that's a number needed to treat then of 12 compared to nicotine replacement, but the NNT compared to nothing is 6. So that's really pretty impressive. Short-term abstinence was better in the e-cigarette group as well. That's not as important. So this is very interesting. The first excellent, well-done randomized trial showing that e-cigarettes can be an effective way to help patients stop smoking. But there is a downside, of course. At 1 year, 40% of the patients in the e-cigarette group were still using the e-cigarettes. So they were hooked on nicotine. Maybe that's better than tobacco, although we don't know enough about the toxicity of e-cigarettes yet. But 60% weren't using anything, of those that quit, that is. So this looks like a potentially useful way of using e-cigarettes. I think we need to see more randomized trials yet before we can give final judgment.
So interesting study. I think it's great that we're finally seeing some, you know, well-designed research around e-cigarettes. There's been a lot of, you know, observational data, a lot of speculation, a lot of sort of belief-based stuff around these. And, you know, I think, you know, the main thing is having the right patient, you guys, don't you think, you know, a motivated patient who really does want to quit.
Yes. Yeah. And of course, the big issue now is not this. The big issue is getting teens hooked on nicotine at a young age. So there's lots going on in the country right now regarding regulation of e-cigarettes. So there's a whole lot more that needs to be done. On the balance, will e-cigarettes be more good than harm? I have my doubts.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. I certainly see a lot of that around town here. Henry, any comments?
Yeah, so I have to step back and think about all of those other studies that have been done over the past couple of decades using nicotine replacement as an adjunct to smoking cessation. I don't remember what proportion of people a year out are still using the nicotine replacement. And my bet is it's not anywhere close to 40%. And if that's the case, then I really have to wonder how much of this data, this study data, will be used as a ploy that would actually be used to continue to endorse e-cigarettes as a safe and effective alternative as opposed to other forms of nicotine replacement therapy. So there's just the paranoia in me. And maybe if I get a chance, I will try to do some further digging on some of the long-term outcomes.
Yeah, they just, you know, haven't been around long enough to know. I mean, I would, my belief is that they are probably on balance safer than, you know, tobacco, you know, cigarettes, but I don't know that. I mean, that's just a belief. So I think you're right. We need more data on that. Henry, you have the next poem. We're talking about quite a range of topics today. This one is antidepressants for irritable bowel.
Very typical of primary care is that we often don't know what we're going to face from day to day. So if you recall a few episodes ago, we reviewed a systematic review meta-analysis of probiotics, prebiotics, and antibiotics for the treatment of patients with irritable bowel syndrome. And for the most part, we weren't terribly impressed with the information that was out there and kind of promised that we would revisit today's study, which had just been published. So the question is, are antidepressants and psychological therapies effective in decreasing symptoms in patients with irritable bowel syndrome? This was published in the American Journal of Gastroenterology the first part of this year. This was a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials. The authors did a lot of good stuff. They searched multiple databases, registries, abstracts of conference proceedings to try to capture as many relevant studies as they could. They ultimately included 53 trials. These were generally small, ranging from 15 to 172 patients. 17 of the studies compared antidepressants with placebo. 35 compared psychological therapies with control therapy or usual care. And one study compared both psychological therapy plus antidepressants with placebo. So if you look at the data on antidepressants, there were only about 1,100 patients in those studies. Four of the 17 studies were at low risk of bias, so generally spotty quality. If you look at global improvement, slightly more than half of the patients getting active treatment reported global improvement compared to about a third of the placebo-treated patients. So number needed to treat somewhere around 5. Additionally, about half of the patients reported improvement in abdominal pain on active treatment compared to about a quarter on placebo. And so that translates into a number needed to treat of 4. Common problem in most studies is they don't report harms. And in this study, they only identified 8 that reported adverse effects, and roughly a third of those getting active treatment compared to about 20% of those getting placebo reported significant adverse events. So that's a number needed to harm of 9. The psychological studies, while there were more studies and more numbers of patients, 2,500, there was a whole potpourri of treatments, including cognitive behavioral therapy, relaxation, internet-based CBT, psychotherapy, stress management, and various combinations of things. Most of the studies were at low risk of bias, so they generally tried to do a good job. And roughly half of the patients getting psychological treatment reported improvement compared to about a quarter of control. So again, numbers needed to treat somewhere in the 5 range, but there was a lot of heterogeneity. And so these numbers may actually be quite much bigger. So for the most part, what we see is that antidepressants and psychological treatments are both quite effective in the management of symptoms in patients with irritable bowel syndrome. Turns out that the tricyclic antidepressants were especially more effective, especially with regards to pain.
Interesting. And, you know, I think another thing that I always think about with irritable bowel, obviously common complaint, is that in patients with diarrhea predominant irritable bowel, particularly women, particularly in their 40s and 50s, keep in mind a microscopic colitis that's classified as either lymphocytic and collagenous colitis, but basically it's a normal looking bowel wall that doesn't do a very good job of absorbing water due to inflammation, but lower grade than ulcerative colitis. It's not uncommon and worth ruling out with a biopsy, which can be done with Flexig as well as colonoscopy in those folks. John, anything to add?
As well as a certain percent of these patients having gluten sensitivity. So that's something to consider as well.
Yeah,
I wanted to comment.
The US now, right?
Yes. I wanted to comment a number needed to treat, a number needed to harm. There are two ways of looking at this. One is the difference between the treatment and the control. But another way of looking at number needed to treat and harm is absolute differences. So for example, if 52% of the actively treated patients had improvement in abdominal pain, that's really a number needed to treat of 2 compared to nothing. And similarly with harm, at 36% of actively treated, that's 1 out of 3 patients have some kind of harmful side effects. So this is for drugs. And so drugs don't look real good in that sense, because the numbers needed to treat and harm are pretty close.
Yeah, good point. Good point. So certainly worth discussing with our patients and seeing which of these approaches are the best fit for them and considering trying one of them or more. Anyway, we are on to the quiz. This is an elevated level was the question of which of the following blood tests is the best predictor of CAP, community-acquired pneumonia, among patients presenting with low respiratory infection in primary care. The options were white blood cell count, serum procalcitonin, left shift in the differential, and C-reactive protein. So CBC and left shift are certainly, while they're associated with infection, they're actually quite nonspecific and have not been shown to be good independent predictors in previous studies where they've done logistic regression to try to figure out what are the best independent predictors of community-acquired pneumonia. And white blood cell count and left shift just generally don't make it into that mix. I think the best data comes from a really good study done in Europe about 5-6 years ago called the GRACE study. And they looked at CRP and procalcitonin as well. They recruited 2,800 patients presenting to a primary care doctor with cough and at least one lower respiratory symptom. They systematically gathered the same data on all of them, including signs, symptoms, blood work, including CRP and procalcitonin. Then everyone got a chest x-ray, so they could use that as the reference standard for pneumonia. They found pneumonia in about 4% of patients. They found that when they created a model that included signs and symptoms, these signs and symptoms were the best predictors: absence of runny nose, shortness of breath, crackles on exam, diminished vesicular breath sounds, pulse over 100, and fever. And when they took that model and they added procalcitonin to it, it didn't add anything to the accuracy. On the other hand, adding C-reactive protein did improve the accuracy. So CRP is actually, among blood tests, the best one in the primary care setting for helping you rule in or rule out pneumonia. And a CRP in this case of greater than 30 milligrams per liter was the cutoff. So some of you probably do practice in places where you can get that test fairly quickly. It's fairly widely used in Europe as a point of care test that just takes a few minutes. And in fact, next week, we'll be getting trained up on how to use that device as part of a research protocol where we'll be recruiting patients with lower respiratory infection, checking CRP, and then following them for a month. And then, among other things, to see how they do and to see if it's a predictor of kind of a benign course. So stay tuned on that. It'll be a few years before we have all the results in. Guys, thanks so much for joining me today. Audience, thanks for tuning in. Love us on social media. Love us on iTunes. Give us some nice comments and reviews. That helps us get more listeners. Hope you all enjoyed today's discussion, and we will talk to you soon.